This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The first principle of communication is to appreciate that communication is taking place at all times. What is it that we're communicating at all times when any two people are within communication range? The first thing that we're communicating is a mood, how we feel. Even when you're standing in a lift, looking up at the numbers, as now that the tapes go to America, apart from to English-speaking nations, we better translate lift as elevator. Even if you're standing in a lift or an elevator, busy looking up at the figures as they go, first floor, second floor, third floor, fourth floor, and everybody's looking up at the figures as if it's some magic oracle which is about to, like an Urim V'Tumim, some magic information is about to be announced unexpectedly, you're still communicating. What you're communicating is, I don't wish to talk to you and I don't wish to be talked to. That's what you're saying. But that too is a communication. That too is a message which you're transmitting. So one communicates a mood. Do we want, are we in the mood for conversation or aren't we in the mood for conversation? Do we feel cheerful or don't we feel cheerful? If you walk around with a sulky, scowly face, you're telling everybody exactly how you feel. That's a communication, no difference to telling them in words. I feel miserable, I feel down, I feel dejected, depressed. That's what one is saying when one walks around with a long face. And it's interesting that people would be reluctant to go around saying that. How many people would be prepared to walk into a room full of other people and say, ladies and gentlemen, I'm feeling miserable, I'm depressed and I'm sad and heartbroken. I would like you all to know. What's anybody else's business? But to communicate that non-verbally, he sees nothing wrong with it. He feels quite comfortable walking around with a scowling, miserable, depressed face. Although he's doing exactly the same, he is imposing his mood on other people. Not very nice, but people do it. And it's socially acceptable to some degree. The other thing that we're communicating at all times is something about our own self-image, how we feel about ourselves. By the way we dress, by the way we walk, by the way we talk, by the stature with which we bear ourselves, by the dignity with which we operate, we're communicating a great deal about the way we feel about ourselves. And thirdly, and perhaps most important of all, we're communicating the way we feel about the person to whom we're communicating. Those are the messages which are being transmitted backwards and forwards between any two people at all times, no matter what. Those are the messages. You meet a stranger, there's immediately a summing up. He's telling you by the way he's dressed, by the way he walks, by the way he talks, what he thinks of himself, and by the way he responds to you, whether he ignores you or he addresses you, and the way he addresses you and what he says to you, he's telling you also what he thinks about you. This is particularly important in child raising, because in child raising the whole self-image has to be constructed in the home. The child is born without a self-image. So in the case of child raising, you're starting with a clean slate. Who's going to mould the self-image? The parents and the family are going to mould the self-image. Using what mechanism? By communication. By sending out constant messages to the child as to what the parents think of the child. If the parents think highly of the child will develop a sense of self-esteem. One has to balance it off to make sure that the self-esteem doesn't become arrogance. That's part of the delicacy of communication and of raising of children. But there we see it very clearly, how every message that a parent emits is a message of what I think of you. And that consequently will make an enormous difference to what the child thinks of himself, as it is with all of us. There's no question that if we negotiate a wonderful deal, and our fellow negotiator or our bosses or whatever it is tell us that that was an absolutely brilliant performance, classy, world class, perfect, outstanding, one walks out feeling different. One's self-esteem has changed. Why? Because somebody else thinks highly of me. And that message is communicated and becomes very valuable to me. And likewise the other way around. If one experiences a blow, and one is told that one's useless, and one's made a mess of everything that one has tried, and that one's never really going to make it, and why don't you just go and clean the streets, you'll probably do that a little bit better. If we have any kind of respect for the person who's sending out that message, we feel shattered, we feel broken, we feel dejected, our self-image is taken a loop. So we see from those two extreme examples how our own self-image is fragile and is in the hands of others. That's a very frightening thought. But if we're going to communicate, of course, if we're going to lock ourselves up in a room and not come into contact with any member of society, we could develop a self-image. Well, I suppose we couldn't develop a self-image at all. But if we're going to allow ourselves to engage in the building process of self-esteem and self-image through communication, we've got to realize that our self-esteem is now in the hands of others. There is a communication that demands a response, and there's a communication that doesn't demand a response. And the communication that doesn't demand a response is really a very shallow form of communication, because it's not dynamic, it doesn't set anything into motion. They tell you when you go on these sales courses, I believe, that one of the things you should do when you present is to communicate in a way that demands response. For example, if you're selling vacuum cleaners to households, you go into the lady, into the lady, the owner of the madam of the household, and you display your vacuum cleaner, and you say to her, "This is the most outstanding vacuum cleaner on the market." What does that achieve? The next thing you say to her is, "You need one of these." What does that achieve? How about if you turn it around and you say, "Wouldn't you agree that a vacuum cleaner with a Mercedes-Benz engine and a Rolls-Royce body is the finest vacuum cleaner that you can possibly acquire?" And she has to say yes, would it? Sure, agree. So you've got response. "Wouldn't you agree that a vacuum cleaner with a Mercedes-Benz engine and a Rolls-Royce body that only costs 25 Rand is an absolute Messiah?" Yes, she has to agree. Got response. "Wouldn't you agree that a household as busy as yours and a housewife as meticulous and as tidy as you needs a machine such as this?" What's she going to say? No. Yes, she does. You've got response. You've instituted communication which demands response. It's a different kind of communication altogether. Now, some people call that kind of communication manipulation. I have made her agree with me in a line of agreements which is eventually going to end up with, "Well, please sign the order." Is that manipulation? Yes, it is manipulation. How bad is manipulation, and how far is manipulation part of communication? A human being only feels effective if he is having an influence on his environment. If you can imagine a situation where a person can have no influence on his environment at all. Imagine you come into a room and you're not allowed to speak. You're not allowed to touch anything, move anything. Absolutely not. All you can do is stand there. How long can you do it? How long is it possible? One imagines sometimes that if we had access to the most beautiful art galleries and museums, we could spend hours and hours and hours there. But even those of us that are most inclined that way, when we finally get to such museums and art galleries, how long can we really spend there? After half an hour, you start getting tired. 3/4 of an hour and a half, you need to go out. Take a breather. What are you tired of? What have you been doing so hard? You've been tired of getting no feedback. You've been tired of just being able to look, of having no effect. There's a limit to what extent a human being can survive in an environment where he cannot have any impact. The self-esteem, the sense of self-esteem, the building of the self-image is all a function of the degree of impact that I've been able to have on my environment. If I can take an empty plot of land, and with my own hands I can build and I can construct there, and I can build a massive building, and afterwards I can point to it and I can show my friends, "This I built," there's a sense of self-esteem. I've done something. I've changed the environment. That's something that is valuable to a human being. And perhaps one of the most important areas of fulfillment is in the area of being able to have impact in changing human beings, in changing people. Because if we change a plot of land, or we build a business or whatever, that's one object that we've created. Very fine. It's an act of creation. We've painted a picture. We've sculpted a piece of sculpture. We've created something. But when we've had impact on a human being who is himself a creator, then we have had impact on a chain effect of creations. Of a person who will be a parent and who as a result of that impact will change the way he raises his children, who will change the way they raise their children, etc., etc., and so on. The way they interrelate with other people. And so from a small impact on one individual, one is in fact having a very large impact on many individuals. And so in terms of feedback, there is no more valuable feedback, there is no more valuable sense of achievement that can be sensed in a human being than the sense of achievement experienced in having impact on other people. Does that mean manipulating other people? Yes, it does. It means making other people change their beliefs, change their value system, change their conduct and behavior. Yes, that's what it means. But provided one is being guided by a value system which is authentic, and one is satisfied that any such change that in behavior or value system or beliefs that one brings about in other people is in fact for the good of that person and not for one's own good, or not only for one's own good, or not necessarily for one's own good, then there is nothing immoral in the act of manipulation. If a salesman goes into a person and conducts a sale and manipulates the prospect into buying the article, is that immoral? It depends what the article is. The article might be an exercise machine which saves him from having a heart attack later on. The article might be a computer program which saves him fortunes of money in one way or another. The article might be the vacuum cleaner that we talked about, which ensures that the shalom bayis, the husband comes home and the house is clean, and the salesman, through selling this, through manipulating the housewife into buying the vacuum cleaner, has created shalom bayis in the home. If the salesman is motivated, which only the truly great salesmen are, motivated by the good of the clients, and he understands that his long-term business prospect relies on the fact that people feel that they have in fact done better out of dealing with him than they would have had they not dealt with him, they feel very gratified. And there's nothing immoral in manipulating a person into a decision which one knows is in their good, and which is done irrespective of what good it brings to the individual concerned. That's what teaching is. That's what raising children is. And it's perhaps a vagueness in this area which has resulted in education being confused with information communication. Merely conveying information to another person, that's not communication. That's not what we mean by communication. Communication is when we're able to alter the beliefs or the conducts of another human being through our interaction. Then there's communication. Communication is not only important in being initiated, communication is equally important in response. There has to be a responsiveness as well. So one has to, if one initiates, one should initiate a form of communication which demands response, which somehow involves the other person, so that there is dynamics, that there is communication. And if one is being communicated to, one needs to be sensitive to read that communication accurately and to respond to it properly. Perhaps the most primitive and basic of initiations of communication which demand response is a smile. You smile at a person, can be a stranger, doesn't matter. As long as he sees clearly that you're smiling at him, he can't just look at you blankly. He's got to respond, smile back. Very simple, basic communication. And more socially accepted communication is a greeting. You say good morning to somebody, it's socially unacceptable for them to ignore you. It demands a response. And though we belittle the social tradition, the social dogma of good morning, how are you, fine, thanks, and you, and all that kind of thing, what it has done is it started communication. It's for people, for societies who find communication a little difficult, such as our society, start over the good morning, that's quite socially acceptable, you can say it to anybody. And it demands a response. He says, good morning back. What now? Good morning. Okay, what now? So society has already worked out the next step. How are you? Fine, thank you. I'm well. How are you? Also fine, thank you. So you're back to square one. It's a bit difficult. But at least there's been some kind of communication has been started. It is not as valueless as it sounds. And if one wants to really start the communication, one says, how are you? He says, fine, thanks to you. You're so terrible. What is the other person going to say? He can't say nothing. He's going to say a shame. Expression of sympathy. But that oh shame isn't good enough. Of course, that closes communication. Oh shame. But that's what he's communicating. He's saying, oh shame, I'm not interested anymore. Just leave me alone. That's what it means. Or he might say, oh shame, what's the matter? Opening the channel for further. These are two strangers who never talked to each other before. I won't trouble you with it. That gives him the option to say, no, please go ahead. I'd like to hear. Why are you so miserable? What's happened? And all of a sudden, two strangers have established communication. And an enormous amount of self-esteem results, particularly if the person to whom one is communicating has self-esteem himself. If one walks into one's building and the cleaner, busy mopping up the floor, says, "Good morning, boss." I say, "Good morning, how are you?" "Fine, thanks." And you, that doesn't do all that much for the self-esteem. But if the managing director of Anglo-American Corporation happens to be walking by and he gives you a very warm, hearty, "Good morning, how are you?" "Good morning," a little conversation ensues, you feel good. Why? Because a person who has high self-esteem has felt it worthwhile creating communication with you. So you must also have esteem in his eyes, at least. It's a comment. And that's why self-esteem and communication go so closely hand in hand with one another. That's why it's terribly important. The value of the communication depends not only on the sincerity of the communication and on the skills of the communicator, it depends also on the image that the communicator is communicating of himself. Now we find this in various chazal. A simple area is the Gemara in Brachos Tachov on the days. V'omer Rabbi Chelva on the Ratzuna. Kol sheyodea bechaveiro shehu rogil litein loyshalim yakdim loyshalim. If you see anybody who you know would normally greet you, you greet first. So we see there's a requirement in the Torah of initiating social communication rather than being the responder. If possible, be the initiator. If you know that he's the type of person who would greet you, you get him first. The Gemara says further on that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was never greeted by anybody first, not even a goy in the marketplace, a stranger. Whoever he encountered, he got the greeting in first. The great Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, no matter where he was walking, he got the greeting in first. It's interesting, there used to be a time when if you found another frum person, there was automatically communication, there was automatically a greeting. Not in just in Johannesburg, this was all over the world. Yerushalayim, even on Shabbos, you went for a walk down the streets in Yerushalayim, and other people, good Shabbos, you greeted each other as you passed. Today, you walk past another, both going to shul, both on Shabbos, walk past and look at each other and scowl at each other and walk on. That's not true. That's not what it's meant to be. There's meant to be an initiation of communication. And if one didn't manage to initiate being nosan loy veloy herzir, but if he actually greets you and you don't greet back, nikro gazla, then you call the thief. You have stolen something from him. He entrusted you with something and you haven't given it back. If a person opens himself up to you and offers you his greeting, his expression of the esteem in which he holds you, and you haven't returned it, you're a gazla. You've kept something which belongs to him. You've kept something which he entrusted to you, and it belongs to, and you haven't given it back. Shneema va'atem bi'artem akerem gozal gzelos ha'oni bevaseichem. The theft of the poor man is in your home, and Rashi explains by loy gzelos ha'oshi gzelohi. What's so special about the theft of a poor man? What's the difference if the man is poor or wealthy? If it's stolen, it's stolen. Elo gzelos ha'oni she'in loy klum ligzol mimen. We're talking about an oni, a poor man who has nothing to steal. He doesn't possess anything. Is it possible to steal something from a man who doesn't possess anything? Yes. You can steal his greeting. If he offers you a greeting and you don't greet him back, that's a theft. You've stolen his self-esteem, you've stolen his dignity in a way which is difficult to ever repay. Nikro Gazlan once called a rabbi. So there we see on the very simple level of greeting, how it has to be. I spoke to some of the parents in the Beis HaMedrash this morning about the behavior of the children, and I made the point that we must not expect the schools to educate our children. I don't know of any Jewish school in the city, and very few in the world, that educate children. They give information to children, and the children absorb the information. But very few schools educate children. And this is one of the areas where you'll see it. I'm talking about our own shul, and I don't believe it's much better anywhere else. How many children come up and say good Shabbos to me? How many children do I see pushing past other adults on the Shabbos after shul? Not greeting. Good Shabbos, Mr. So-and-so. Good Shabbos, Mr. So-and-so. That's only for adults. That's not for children. Do you think that the children are going to grow up into adults who understand this concept? Oh, no, they won't. You forget that you grew up with this concept. Although you might have grown up in non-religious environments, although you might have grown up in a non-frum home, you grew up in a home where your parents said to you, please greet Mr. So-and-so and stand up when they walk in. That's why you know how to do it. Don't think your children are going to pick it up from somewhere. They're going to pick it up from nowhere. They will not understand the importance of this, of greeting, of returning a greeting. Where are they going to pick it up from unless they're told to do it and they're picked out every time they don't do it? That's something that has to be taught. Another case the Gemara said gives. Same page of the Gemara. Same page of my Gemara. What the Gemara says is the kol hanene b'su'udas chosom, that anybody who has a benefit from a su'udas chosom, a wedding, he goes to a chasna or to a sheva brachos, and he enjoys the meal. Ve'eimei samchoi, and he doesn't contribute to the simcha of the chasna. Ve'eimei b'shiva kolis, I think it says. He's over, a terrible thing. What does that mean? There too. Different type of communication. A choson and a kala are getting married. So the parents of the kala or the parents of the choson and kala arrange a chasana. What is the purpose of the arranging of the chasana? To invite their friends to share in the simcha. Why do they want their friends to share in the simcha? Because that's a funny thing about simcha. That a simcha is much greater when it's shared than when it's alone. A human being is in fact not capable of true simcha isolated from society. The simcha is magnified very much more if one's able to share the simcha with others. Sorus are like that and simchas are like that. It's a time that one needs people. One cannot have true simcha on one's own. Imagine a chosen kala getting married with nobody there. Imagine a chosen kala and a chuppah. The Rav says that the birkas eirusin and the birkas nisuin, and he reads the ksuba and he disappears 1, 2, 3, and there they left in the shul and go home now finished. Where is the simcha? There cannot be simcha without a group of people. So the purpose of the chasana is to invite people. Just to invite people, imagine that the suza wasn't provided. So you just send out invitations. Please come and make my son and daughter-in-law happy. They're having a chasana, they're getting married, they can't do it by themselves. Please come and make them happy. That's not the way one communicates. So one sends them an invitation to dinner. Come and join us to dinner. Expecting what? And in response to the dinner, you'll share in the simcha and you'll add to the happiness of the whole occasion. What happens when they come and they eat and they go? And they've added nothing to the simcha? What has happened then? It's exactly the same as the oni, as the man who's offered his greeting has been taken and hasn't been returned. So one is accepting the communication, it is a communication which demands response. And one is accepting a communication which demands response, and one is not responding. And that's that same kind of negativity that can be set up through not responding properly to a communication. So on the one hand, there has to be the initiation of a communication. Number two, there has to be the initiation of a communication which demands response. Number three, there has to be the ability to read that communication and to respond to that communication. And then one has a society established. Then one has give and take. Then one has feedback where a human being feels alive. Loneliness is not the emotion you feel when there are no people around. That's not when you feel lonely. Loneliness is the emotion when there are people around and there's no feedback from the people around. Then one feels lonely. And one doesn't feel lonely. In the ladies' shiur today, we had a third area of communication. And that's the area of family communication, which perhaps is the most important of all. Because the purpose of a family, one of the major purposes of family living, is the richness of communication that can take place under the family roof. The openness of communication, the trusting degree, because for communication there has to be trust. If I believe that I'm going to be snubbed, I'm not going to greet. I don't want the greeting thrown back in my face. So if I believe, that's why the Gemara says, who do you have to greet first? somebody who you know greets you. You don't have to greet first somebody who you know is going to snub you. No such chiyuv. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he was a midas chassidus. Nobody ever greeted him first. But the halacha is you've got to ensure that somebody who you know would greet you, you greet first. But in a situation where you're not sure, you smile at somebody and they'll scowl back at you and feels, well, I don't want to take the risk sometimes, so we don't smile. Rather scowl at them, let them smile. And it's also wrong. But in a family, that doesn't apply. In a family, there can be a trust. We can assume that the other members of the family are not going to deal harshly and insensitively with our efforts to communicate. We might not like what they say, but we're not talking about the subjects of communication. That doesn't matter for the purposes of our discussion. We're talking about the causes of communication and the effect of communication. It makes no difference what the communication is. If there is communication, then there is a slow process of the construction of esteem. There is the feedback which makes one feel creative, which makes one feel potent. One is having an effect on the world, irrespective of what that effect is. Sometimes a child will misbehave, and if the parent does not respond in the appropriate way, which may be to give the child a patch, the child feels insecure. The child has sent out a message which has aroused no response, or even worse, the wrong response. There's a failure of communication. The child knows what to expect when he misbehaves, and he's trying it out to see whether he knows how to communicate properly. He's also manipulating the parent, and if the parent doesn't respond, that's very serious. The child feels a failure in his communication and wonders whether his parent is tuned into him altogether. And just as important, when the child asks a question and the parent ignores answering the question, when the child says something which is good, which deserves a little bit of praise, or does something which is good, which deserves praise, and the parent ignores to give the praise, all that sets up in the child the feeling of either I can't trust my parents with communication because they don't know how to communicate, or it creates the impression there must be something wrong with me. I don't know how to communicate. Whatever I try doesn't seem to arouse any response. I try doing well at school, they don't notice. I try doing a couple of mitzvahs and chesed at home and respecting them, they don't seem to notice. So I try being naughty, I'm naughty, they don't seem to notice either. So there must be something wrong with me. I can't communicate. I can't arouse a response in other people. And the self-image goes into decline. But one of the most important areas of all is the area of husband-wife communication. And that's a dangerous sort of area, because the tendency there is to get oneself into a habit of taking things so for granted that one thinks that communication isn't necessary. And you often hear the claim that at least at home I don't have to worry about communication, about how I appear. I don't need to worry about what I say. At home I can call a spade, and I can unwind and be myself. That is so opposite to the truth. At home you've got to realize that you're being watched all the time, that you are being communicated to and communicated from at all times, day and night. There's the time you've got to be most careful of what you're communicating, of what you're saying, of how you're coming across. This morning we learned the Gemara where Rabbi Yossi encounters Eliyahu HaNavi. And as happens often when the Tanoim or Amoraim had the privilege of meeting up with Eliyahu HaNavi, they posed a troubling question to him, a question to which they had no answer and which they had no approach to researching the answer, in the hope that Eliyahu HaNavi would open the way for them in that particular query. Omalein, he says to Eliyahu, Ksiv Eseh Lo Yezeh. Says in the Torah, before Hashem creates the wife, he says, let me make a help for Adam. Asks Rabbi Yossi a very serious kasha. Bame Isha Ozata Eliyahu. Explain to me, Eliyahu HaNavi, what does a woman do for him? Strange kasha. But not really so strange, because what Rabbi Yossi is saying is, what is she meant to do? Is she meant to clean the house up? I can hire a shitzer for that. Is she meant to do the laundry? I can hire a laundrymaid for that. Is she meant to cook and bake? I can hire a cook and a baker for that. What is it that a woman is meant to do? In what way is she an ezer? In what way does she help her husband in an area that he could not have done it himself? In no way, nor could he have hired somebody that it has to be an isha, it has to be a wife that does it. And if that's the meaning of Rabbi Yossi's kasha, then Eliyahu's answer is very strange. Omare, says Eliyahu, Odo mevi chitim. Chitim koses. If a man brings home wheat, can he chew the wheat? Pishtan levesh. If he brings back flax, can he wear the flax? Lo nintzeis meiro inov. Umamidose araglov. Don't we see that she brings life to his eyes and puts him onto his feet?
What does Eliyahu HaNavi mean? He's answering exactly that. Yes, she grinds the wheat and she weaves and that's what she is. But that was the whole question that Rabbi Yossi posed. I don't need her to mill the wheat. I can send her to the mill. I don't need her to bake. I can buy bread from the baker. I don't need her to weave to spin the linen and to weave the garments. I can buy garments ready woven. So what is Eliyahu answering him? Can you choose wheat and can you wear flax? But clearly Eliyahu is answering him that the woman's role is to take raw material which the husband brings into the home and to make of that the finished article. So the husband should not bring the bread into the home, he should bring the wheat. Not literally, but metaphorically. He should not bring the garments into the home. He should bring the linen. It's her job to finish it off. It's her job to take the raw material and to make that into something which can be used, into something which can be seen. There's the area of self-esteem. Both ways. She respects him because he brings the raw material. The physical raw material, and the spiritual raw material, and the intellectual raw material, and the emotional raw material. He has sources for that. He can generate that. He goes to a shiur and he learns Gemara and he gets stimulated. And he goes to work and he gets stimulated. And he meets with his chavrusas and his chaverim and he gets stimulated. That stimulation has to be brought into the home. And it's brought into the home in the form of raw material. Ideas, value systems, thoughts, mitzvahs, material, feelings, emotions. And she's able to take it and work through it and integrate it and feed it back into the home. So that he sees reflections of his own ideas in the home. He sees it now in a practical sense. He sees a living portrayal of the value system and the ideas which he put in the raw material. Just as he would relate to the loaf of bread in relationship to the wheat that he brought in initially. And then Eliyahu says, Lehintzeis mehiro einov. Doesn't that mean that she lights up his eyes? And we discussed, based on the Medrash in Iyuv, that that's what light is. The Medrash in Iyuv on the Pasuk Oir Choshach Be'ovalo, that a man's light is extinguished in his tent. The Neiroi Olov Yidoch, and his candle is put out before him. The Medrash says on that, the Gemara says, that O Choshach, O Eloi, that's a man whose wife has died. The light has been extinguished in his home. The candle which is put out, that's not the wife. The candle is the man. The source of energy is the man. But if you put a candle in a room, in a black room, where there is nothing that can reflect at all, everything is pitch black and there isn't any other source of light that comes in, only the candle. There isn't light in it. You can see the candle, but the candle doesn't light up the room. A man can have a value system, he can have Torah, he can be stimulated, he can have ideas, all very fine, but that doesn't light up the home. It's the reflective material, it's the walls, and it's the carpets, and it's the furniture, and it's the pictures on the wall. All that takes the light and re-diffuses it and reflects it in a way which is original and creative and different. It makes the light comforting, it makes the light welcoming. That's what the wife is able to do. To take the nail, to take the source of energy, and to convert that into light. Then there's communication, then there's feedback. He brings the candle in, she takes the candle and converts it into light, and feeds it back to him. And so it goes backwards and forwards, and there's communication. That's the unique communication, says Eliyahu HaNavi, between husband and wife. This is not a verbal communication, this is not even a non-verbal communication. This is a different level of communication altogether. And how tragic it is in family situations where there isn't that communication. Where the husband either is not a source of energy, he's not being stimulated, he's not bringing new ideas into the home, he's not bringing enthusiasm into the home, or sometimes he is, and the wife is not doing anything with it. She's busy with her own ideas, and she's busy with her own career, with whatever it is, or she's just not turned on and not communicating. And she doesn't take those ideas, and she doesn't do anything with them. And there's a lack of communication altogether. There can be two people who are living together, and who are both desperately lonely, because there isn't any real communication. Each one going along his own thing, thinking that they're communicating, thinking that good morning is a communication, thinking that a hello is a communication. It's not on a husband-wife level. The communication required there is much deeper, is much more all-embracing than the mere social communication which is adequate for the stranger that one happens to see in the street. even the little forms of communication are important in the husband-wife relationship. There too, there is the situation of the need for the building of self-esteem. A husband who lacks self-esteem devalues the value of his communications. If he acts like a nobody and he thinks of himself as a nobody, then when he gives a compliment, it's not worth very much. But a husband who is building his self-esteem, a husband who is developing his personality, who is developing his character, who is developing his intellect, and feels that worth and that self-esteem, when he delivers the compliment, it means something. But you need two conditions. Number one, the husband needs to be developing. And number two, he needs to be communicating. He needs to respond, he needs to say, he needs to notice. And when she communicates, he needs to pick it up. He needs to be able to tell from a gesture, from an expression on a face, that she's had a hard day. Shouldn't be necessary for her to have to verbalize it. He should be sensitive to that. He should notice changes. He should be sensitive to nuances and be able to respond to that. This is all part of interpersonal communication. He should be able to initiate communications which demand responses. To come home and issue instructions, that's not communication. To come home and communicate in a way which requires response, which demands response, and to take that response and reform it and throw it back again in a new form of communication, that's communication which is meaningful. And there is a construction of self-esteem, there is a feeling of not living in a vacuum. There's a feeling of, there's a reality to it. There's a possibility of working with somebody, there's a possibility of changing somebody and changing myself. One cannot change oneself if one doesn't have the equipment to do so. If you go to, if you want to develop your muscles, you need to go to a gym and you need to work yourself against something else, even if it's only the floor, that you push yourself up and down on the floor, but you need something. So it is when you're developing character and personality or spirit. You need somebody that you're working with, somebody that's reflecting. If you send off a message, you shout and you're in a completely soundproof room. They've driven people to sugar like that. But locking people up in rooms which are completely soundproof and absolutely dark, where light receives no feedback and sound receives no feedback. We need the echoes. We need to hear our own voice coming back to us for it to be meaningful. To be in a situation where you can't hear even your own voice, eventually one becomes a little bit unable to develop any sense of security and confidence. All this responsiveness to communication rests on one other principle. The Gemara says in Yuma the Samach Gimel, Sanhedrin the Kaf Gimel, the Gemara says that when does a man lose a wife, that's for sure. And one of the cases is mi shemevakshim mimenu momen ve'enu. If they ask for money from a person and he doesn't have, and he loses his wife. Terrible thing. What does that mean? Who asks him for money? Robbers come along and ask him for money and he doesn't have? Can't be. They ask him for tzedakah. They come and make a collection and the shulach comes and says, I need a donation, and he hasn't got any money. Is that a reason for his wife to die? If he hasn't got money, he's potter. So what does it mean, mevakshim mimenu momen ve'in lo? A man from whom money is requested and he hasn't got what to pay. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, that's talking about a man whose creditors ask for money and he hasn't got what to pay. Asks Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, so what? Can happen. Is that a reason to lose a wife? Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, a person who is responsive, a person who feels indebtedness, and doesn't like to feel indebted, a person who is sensitive to indebtedness, will never allow himself into a situation where he owes money and he's got no assets. He will never do that. If he's allowed himself into a situation where he's borrowed money and he hasn't got what to repay, we're not talking about a person who has bad cash flow, and it would mean, so let's say you'll sell something. We're talking about a man who hasn't got what to repay, he's borrowed more than his assets. That's a person who doesn't care about being indebted. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, such a person doesn't deserve a wife. Because the communication between husband and wife depends on a distaste for indebtedness. That's the only way it can work, where one feels the indebtedness to a wife and the need to respond to that indebtedness. So that everything she communicates is responded to. That she isn't allowed to operate in a vacuum. She's got to feel that when she expresses herself, it's being heard and it is being responded to. And if he is a person who is capable of borrowing money without the ability to repay that money, he's a person who doesn't mind feeling indebted. And a person who doesn't mind feeling indebted is not fit to be married to a wife. That's part of the relationship. What did Eliyahu HaNavi say? The essence of that relationship is give and take. Feedback. Bring the raw material. And she takes the wheat. What does she do with the wheat? She grinds the wheat. And she makes it into flour. And she bakes it into bread. And she's had a difficult day grinding. Imagine the physical labors and grinding the wheat in the old days and putting it all together and baking it. And she brings him the bread. And what does he do with it? Eats it all up. Let's go now. I say, the people became the chesed. Off he goes. She's left. Empty table. He brought the wheat. She made the bread. He ate the bread. He's gone. What's she left with? Absolutely nothing. That's a person who doesn't understand indebtedness. A person who hasn't appreciated what she's gone through to produce that work, and hasn't given her something in exchange for that work and for that effort. If he gives her something in exchange, the dynamics continue. He brings the wheat, she makes the bread. His face lights up, and with a warm and affectionate smile, he says to her, "This bread, it's worth anything to come. Where do you find bread like this? Who else can bake bread like this?" And it's meant with the sincerity and with warmth. And he gives her another affectionate smile, and then he benches, or he says so, after he benches, and then he goes off back to work. And she feels warm inside. And she's now preparing, what can I have ready for him when he comes home from work the next time? What can I have for him? And so it goes backwards and forwards. A person who couldn't care less. Borrows money, can't pay. It's not working. You tell me that in person. You go through the motions at least. You're doing your studies. But if you wouldn't turn it over, that would be careless. A person who mavakshim imen and momen v'aimlo doesn't feel anything. Undertakes things, doesn't do what he undertakes. Accepts responsibility, doesn't do anything for his responsibility. Accepts hospitality, doesn't respond to hospitality. Is greeted, doesn't greet back. Doesn't pull his weight, doesn't act, doesn't... Such a person is not going to be able to handle a wife. This is a he doesn't deserve a wife. And that, Chas v'Shalom, is one of the situations where a man, where the Rebbeinu Shlomo causes a man to lose a wife. All that is ben odin l'chaveri, in interpersonal relationships. But lastly, I want to refer to communication between the Ribono Shel Olam and ourselves, using the same principles. We've just concluded Sefer Vayikra. Vayikra, the Sefer Vayikra starts with a word, and it's called Vayikra. What does Vayikra mean? Vayikra is a call, an address. Vayikra el Moshe vayadaber Hashem Elov. Hashem calls to Moshe and speaks to him. What does the calling mean? Says Rashi, L'chol dibrois, or l'chol amirois, or l'chol tzivuyim, kod mo kriyo loshen chibur. Before the Ribbono Shel Olam spoke to Moshe on any occasion, kod mo kriyo, he was first called. What does calling mean? The initiation of a communication which inevitably demands and receives response. He's using somebody's name. You say, Chaimke! Chaimke answers. He looks up. He registers recognition. He says, yes, what do you want? He says, leave me alone. Whatever. But he doesn't ignore you. When you use a person's name, the person responds. That's Sefer Vayikra. That the Ribbono Shel Olam never spoke to Moshe without addressing him by name first. That's God to man. How much more so we to one another. Use each other's name to address each other. Again, watch the children. See how often they use people's names. If they already have the manners to say excuse me before they push past you, do they ever say excuse me Mr. So-and-so, excuse me Mrs. So-and-so, I would like to work. Excuse me. That's already then you already comment on how well mannered the child is. Said excuse me. That's already a big bible. Loshen chibur. A loshen kovod, a husband and wife, parent and child, address the person, use their name, demand response, That's the beginning of a warm communication, Loshin Chibur. The moment you use the person's name, you're demonstrating that you care for the person, that the person is important to you. And Moshe writes Vayikro with a small aleph, Chazal say. So that if you ignore the aleph, it reads Vayoker, which Chazal tell us corresponds to the way the Ribbono Shel Olam used to encounter the non-Jewish prophets, such as Bilam. Vayoker, Loshin Mikre. Just by the way, if you bump into somebody, you don't call him by his name. You don't. If you bump into him, you start the communication directly. It's just by chance. And that word, Vayiker, is a word which is related to the word keri, which is a form of tumor, a form of defilement. It's something which we consider negative. To engage in communication just by chance, without being addressed, that's a communication which lacks a certain dignity, which lacks a certain warmth, which lacks a certain covet. That Sefer Vayikra, the Ribbono Shel Olam, never addresses Moshe without calling him. A person has to be able to feel the communication, he has to be able to feel that he's put out a message and that a message has come back. Otherwise he feels lonely, he feels himself operating in a vacuum. We need to know that there's another area of loneliness, and that's existential loneliness. Feeling a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam and feeling distant from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it's unbelievable how sensitive that relationship is. How easy it is to feel that the Ribbono Shel Olam responds so quickly and so accurately if the relationship is an open one. If one really turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam and relies on him. If one turns to the Ribbono Shel Olam and then forgets about him, of course it doesn't work. But the moment there is a sense of reliance, the moment there is a sense of a feeling within oneself that I cannot do it on my own, I do the Ishtadlus Ribbono Shel Olam, but it's all in your hands. It feels the togetherness so closely. And then even Chas v'Shalom, when there's a clap, when one has a tragedy, but if one knows what it's for, there's a very wonderful feeling inside oneself. And then one corrects the wrong, and one feels it starts getting better. There's a feeling of togetherness, I'm communicating. Hashem pointed something out to me, I fixed it, I responded. Tefillah, he in turn responded. There's a most unbelievable feeling of not loneliness, a feeling of existential togetherness, which has got nothing to do with the social situation. And the human being needs to feel involved. The human being must feel a part of the world in which he operates, both on the interpersonal level and on a bein odom l'malchus. Just as in the interpersonal level, there must always be the vayikra, we must initiate communication. It must be a communication which demands response, and we must possess the skills to identify somebody else's communication and to respond to it. So in our relationships with the Ribbono Shel Olam, there should never be a halicha bekeri, there should never be an attitude of casualness and coincidence, but there too there should be an attitude of vayikra, we calling out to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he responding to us noticing that response and in turn responding either with a birkas hashvach, with a blessing of praise, or with tshuva, a correction of behavior, enabling the Ribbono Shel Olam once again to take up the communication. And if the human being is able to function on these two levels, not in a social vacuum, but with social interaction, in his family, with his children, with his parents, with his wife, with his friends, with his community, with his colleagues, and is able to interrelate with communication, by another Ramokin, he is communicating to the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Ribbono Shel Olam is communicating to him. If tefillah ceases to be a ritual and becomes an important part of the human existential experience, then the human being is able to elevate himself into a feeling of one of intense self-worth, one of progress, and one of great achievement.